Hi, my name's Christine and I'm a newsreader on the Black Country Talking News. This week's edition is for the 24th of March 2021.
Hello. And welcome to the Black Country Talking News, brought to you by sightloss charity Beacon Centre. A message to our listeners who receive the Talking News on CD in the post. This remains in paper envelopes and not the usual plastic wallets, so there's still no need to send anything back to us. We're pleased to confirm that the Talking News is now available via Alexa. All you need to do is say, "Alexa, play Black Country Talking News." Our Talking News service is also available via the following methods: calling 01902 213 210, visiting our website www.beaconvision.org/talking-news, as a podcast on the Black Country Radio website www.blackcountryradio.co.uk/podcasts, on Spotify and Apple Podcasts by simply searching Beacon Black Country Talking News and hitting the subscribe button, and on your mobile or tablet device by downloading the free British Wireless for the Blind Talking News application from your App Store. We hope you enjoy this week's edition.
Thank you, Simon. And we start with a message to our listeners. The Black Country Talking News is taking a 2-week break for Easter. This means we will next be returning on the 14th of April. Reading this week, we have myself, Rob, writer Graham Fisher, Mina, Ed, Pete, Helen, Simon, Liz, Christine, Ian, Angela, and of course, Flashback Roger. In this week's edition, we have an update from Beacon, some local news from the Black Country. We had the Flashback Quiz with Mina, news from West Bromwich Albion and Wolves, a Did You Know section from Flashback Roger, a reflection on COVID-19, the weather, an edition of Sounds of Nature, information about dry eye, and rounding all that off, one of Graham Fisher's tales from the barn. But we start with some local news, brought to us by Angela, Ian and Christine.
NHS bosses say it could take up to 3 years to restore hospital services to their pre-COVID levels. Hospitals across the region are stepping up non-COVID procedures in a bid to reduce waiting lists that have built up over the past year. Thousands of procedures have been delayed, although critical cancer care and heart surgery continued. Professor David Loughton, boss of the Royal Wolverhampton NHS Trust, said staff were being redeployed to other areas of care. He said, "We've got to concentrate on restoring services because waiting lists are back to where they were in the early 2000s and people will be suffering because they haven't had the operation they need. You are talking of 2, maybe 3 years to get back to previous levels because NHS waiting lists are now at a very, very high level." Diane Wake, CEO of Dudley Group NHS Foundation Trust, said she expected Russell's Hall to be back to pre-COVID levels in 6 months. Michelle Rhodes, chief nurse at University Hospitals of North Midlands Trust, said services would be brought back gradually when safe. Professor Loughton said New Cross had seen 3 cases of people vaccinated developing blood clots. He said 2 had received the Pfizer jab and the other AstraZeneca, and there were no concerns as the cases were well within the realms of the normal rate of what you'd expect to see.
A male off-duty police officer convicted of assaulting a woman has been spared jail, sparking criticism from a leading female MP that the system fails women and protects men. PC Oliver Banfield, who serves with West Midlands Police, admitted a charge of assault by beating at an earlier hearing in January, and on Friday he was handed a curfew and ordered to pay compensation and costs at Leicester Magistrates Court. Reacting to the sentence, Labour MP Harriet Harman said on Twitter, "Policeman attacks woman walking home alone after dark. Must have been terrifying for her, but no prison sentence. This is proof, if any needed, that system fails women and protects men." West Midlands Police said Banfield was removed from public-facing duties after the assault, while a criminal investigation into the incident was carried out. The force said that following the end of the criminal investigation process, Banfield was suspended pending the outcome of a disciplinary process into an allegation of gross misconduct against the officer. In a statement, Deputy Chief Constable Vanessa Jardine said, "Oliver Banfield was removed from public-facing police duties after the assault and while the investigation by Warwickshire Police was being carried out. To protect the criminal case, we've not been able to carry out our own misconduct investigation until its conclusion. Now sentencing has taken place, our investigation will be carried out and PC Banfield faces allegations of gross misconduct and is currently suspended. We understand the strength of feelings surrounding the desperately sad death of Sarah Everard and concerns on the issue of women's safety, but it would not be appropriate for us to comment further at this stage. Our role is to protect the public, who should be able to trust us. We therefore hold all our officers to the highest standards and we will take appropriate action against anyone whose actions fall below what is expected."
The West Midlands has been described as an innovator for the number of ways the coronavirus vaccine has been rolled out. Pop-up vaccination services in mosques, mobile vaccination vans, football arenas, museums and cinemas are just some of the ways where people have been able to benefit from the life-saving coronavirus vaccination. The West Midlands delivered the world's first vaccine outside of a clinical trial as part of the largest vaccination program in the NHS's history, when Margaret Keenan received the jab at University Hospital Coventry in December. Since then, the vaccination programme has been rolled out to a number of more unusual partnerships that have helped to accelerate the vaccination programme in the Midlands. Centres have included religious buildings such as mosques, temples, churches, as well as football stadiums like Villa Park, and other sporting venues such as Telford International Centre, Ludlow Racecourse, and Shrewsbury Indoor Bowls Centre. Alison Tung, the regional director responsible for the rollout of the vaccination programme at NHS England and NHS Improvement in the West Midlands, said, "The West Midlands has some of the most diverse populations in the country, so it's vital that we take the vaccine out into communities to ensure everyone has easy access to the vaccine. So, on behalf of the NHS in the West Midlands, I would like to thank every one of our community partners and volunteers for their invaluable support in taking the vaccination service to places where people are most comfortable."
Tourist attractions say they cannot afford another lockdown, warning they are on the brink financially as they prepare to reopen. Outdoor venues will open their gates again from April the 12th, with indoor attractions being likely to open again in May. It means the Easter bank holidays will be missed. Bosses across the region are hoping this could be the final extended closure, and today appealed for the public to show their support by coming back in numbers. Dudley Canal and Tunnel Trust has only been able to open for 15 weeks over the last year. It now hopes to start canal trips and outdoor hospitality from April the 14th, with cavern trips from May the 17th. Tracy Dix-Williams, Chief Executive Officer, said it was essential it is able to open up and stay open, adding, "We cannot stay closed much longer. It is simply not viable for us. Attractions have put incredible investment and time into adapting their businesses so they can offer protection and instill confidence in their visitors. For many attractions, timing is key to having a successful year. Missing out on Easter will have a big impact. We need to make the most of the time we have left in the coming season." In the roadmap out of lockdown, outdoor attractions, including zoos and theme parks, are due to reopen from April the 12th, while indoor attractions could be open as early as May the 17th. And bosses across the region are hoping this could be the final extended closure after a year of uncertainty and financial difficulties. Dudley Zoo and Castle is also looking to reopen on Monday, April the 12th. During the first national lockdown, the attraction had to issue a rallying cry for support after bosses revealed it was losing £100,000 a week while it was closed. The Black Country Living Museum aims to open on Monday, May the 17th, alongside its vaccination centre. The vaccination centre, which opened at the Tipton Road-based site back in January, will continue to operate when the museum reopens.
Frontline staff, including care workers and refuse collectors, are set to receive a financial reward in recognition of their dedication and service during the course of the pandemic. As a gesture of thanks to staff over the last year, Dudley Council will be repaying 12 months' worth of mandatory unpaid leave reductions. Mandatory unpaid leave was first introduced in 2017 and required all staff to take 3 days unpaid leave at Christmas, which meant a 1.15% gross pay reduction over 12 months. The payment will be made to more than 4,500 employees of the local authority, including nearly 3,000 who earn £28,000 a year or less. Councillor Simon Phipps, Cabinet Member for Commercial and Customer Services, said staff across the council have worked tirelessly during the course of the pandemic to keep essential frontline services going and to care for and protect our most vulnerable residents. We can't thank them enough for the sacrifices they have made, even at times when they may have experienced personal loss themselves, and we want to show our gratitude in every way possible. It's only right that we give something back now, and this is a small token to say thank you on behalf of elected members. The repayment will be made in the first 3 months of the new financial year as a one-off payment.
Three more local news bulletins coming up, but now it's time for our weekly update from Beacon.
Hi everyone, it's Helen, back with another weekly update of everything that's been happening at the Beacon Centre. We thought we'd start this week with news of a new virtual activity we're launching. Every Monday from now onwards, you can ease yourself into your week with a coffee and a catch-up at Beacon's new virtual coffee morning taking place at 10 a.m. Don't worry though, we've still got all your other usual favourite sessions as well, and everyone's welcome to join us. To find out more, head to our Facebook page. You just need to search Beacon Centre, where you can find out how to join us via Zoom or telephone in our event section. Alternatively, you can also email or call Kim for more information. Email kwilliams@beaconvision.org, that's kwilliams@beaconvision.org, or call 01902 880111 Mondays to Fridays. I don't know about you, but I think the weather certainly seems to have been a little bit brighter at times in recent weeks. And another sure sign that spring is on the way is that the clocks will be going forward on March 28th at 1 a.m. So finally, we can all look forward to some more daylight in the evenings. If you're struggling with telling the time on your watch or even a clock these days, we can help. There are all kinds of watches and clocks designed to help people with sight loss. If you'd like to find out more and see if there's one suited for you, then why not give our sight loss advisors team a ring on 01902 880 111 Monday to Fridays. Now, while we're all looking forward to the easing of some lockdown restrictions, hopefully anyway in the coming weeks, non-essential retail shops aren't able to open just yet. And while we so appreciate all your donations to our stores, while they remain closed, we ask that people don't leave any donations outside our shops. Unfortunately, we can't accept them and they can cause a hazard. When it's safe to do so, we can't wait to welcome our customers back. And in the meantime, don't forget, you can shop online at our eBay store, www.ebay.co.uk/str/beaconcharityshop. That's www.ebay.co.uk/str/beaconcharityshop. I've been having a look myself recently and there are some fabulous shoes on there. Lastly this week, don't forget there's still time to enter our Easter raffle. Entries are just £2 and the money raised will help support people with sight loss. There are three amazing prizes up for grabs, including a metre high Easter egg for our first prize. Gosh, I think it'd take me all year to get through that. To get your entry, head to www.justgiving.com/fundraising/Beacon Easter Raffle. That's www.justgiving.com/fundraising/Beacon Easter Raffle. Terms and conditions apply. You can find out more details on the webpage. That's it for this week. Hope you're all well and speak to you soon. Bye-bye.
Thanks, Helen. We now head back to the local news. Reading for us, we have Ed, Christine, Angela, and at the top of the bill, it's Ian.
The region's live music scene is set to flourish after a top venue operator takes over at Civic Halls, Tom Watson has said. The former West Bromwich East MP, who is chair of UK Music, hailed the deal that will see AEG Presents run the iconic Wolverhampton venue when it reopens next year. He said the arrival of the global entertainment giant was good news for music lovers across the West Midlands, who could expect to see top quality acts and an excellent live music experience. AEG Presents own and operate more than 40 sites and recently landed the contract to run a music venue at Olympia, London. It also puts on the annual All Points East Festival and has promoted tours for Justin Bieber, Bon Jovi, Shawn Mendes, Rod Stewart and The Who. The firm's CEO, Steve Homer, was born in Stourbridge and was introduced to live music at the Civic in 1978 when he saw The Clash. He said, "Wolverhampton Civic Halls has a great history of being a first-class venue for live music. When looking to expand our portfolio of venues, it was the obvious choice. The council's ambition, commercial drive and significant investment coupled with our desire to provide high-quality entertainment and customer service will forge a great partnership for years to come."
The biggest ever shake-up of Britain's bus network will see new routes and bus lanes and caps on ticket prices, the Prime Minister has announced. During a visit to the West Midlands, Boris Johnson said his £3 billion plan will make buses across the country cheaper and easier to use, with more services enabling passengers to turn up and go. Daily price caps will be introduced so that people can use the bus as many times a day as they need to. Extra services will be put on at evenings and weekends, and contactless payments will be accepted. The plan will also see 4,000 zero-emissions buses launched. Mr. Johnson, who made the announcement at the National Express depot in Coventry, said buses are lifelines and liberators, connecting people to jobs they couldn't otherwise take, driving pensioners and young people to see their friends, sustaining town centres and protecting the environment. The Department for Transport said it hopes to meet its targets through so-called enhanced partnerships that will see local authorities agree to making improvements to infrastructure in return for better services from bus companies. Ignacio Garrett, Group Chief Executive of National Express, said, "The strategy comes at a vital time, and we fully embrace the proposals for operators to work in partnership with local authorities to deliver cleaner, greener services that meet the needs of customers who are increasingly turning to public transport for their daily journeys." The strategy has been welcomed by Wrightbus head Joe Bamford, who plans to have 200 hydrogen buses on the streets of Birmingham in time for next summer's Commonwealth Games. Mick Cash, General Secretary of the National Union of Rail, Maritime and Transport Workers, said the strategy appeared to lack ambition.
More than 7,000 streetlights have been converted into greener and more cost-effective low-energy LEDs. A total of 7,164 older high-energy sodium lamps used on residential and city centre streets in Wolverhampton have been replaced so far. It forms part of Wolverhampton Council's smart lighting scheme, with more than 20,000 lights set to be replaced across the city. The scheme, which was launched in April, has resulted in savings of £105,538, as well as 350,000 kilowatts per hour of energy and 88 tonnes of carbon compared to the previous year. Councillor Steve Evans, Cabinet Member for City Environment at Wolverhampton Council, said, "Our teams are making great progress in replacing our old sodium lamps with the new LED streetlights, and we will soon be ready to move forward with the next phase, which will allow us to control light levels by location. It will not only save us money, but it will support us in our commitment to make Wolverhampton Council carbon neutral by 2028. In addition, it will help us to lower our carbon emissions, reduce our energy consumption, and enable people to choose alternative methods of transport. We have included all of these targets in Wolverhampton's sustainability strategy and implementation plan, and this scheme will help us to make sure there is less cost to our city, both financially and in terms of energy. The smart lighting scheme also supports the UK-wide Smart Cities agenda, making us one of only a handful of cities in the country leading the way in using this technology. Lights have been converted in Bilston, Fallings Park, Heathtown, Wensfield, Low Hill, Moseley Village and Tetnell. More than 20,000 further lights will be changed across the city, a total of 27,570. It will result in savings of around £1 million each year, with carbon emissions cut by more than 1,200 tonnes and 5 million kilowatts of energy per hour will be saved by the end of 2022.
Pubs Group Marston's is to open 93 of its pubs in the Black Country, Staffordshire and Worcestershire on April the 12th, with outdoor service only. Ahead of the next stage of the government's roadmap out of lockdown, Wolverhampton-based Marston's has confirmed that almost 70% of its English pubs will reopen on that date. Pubs that can accommodate customers in outdoor gardens will operate with an adapted offering in line with restrictions. Key details across Marston's pubs regarding reopening include an adapted food and drink offers for customers to enjoy outdoors. To accompany table service, Marston's has introduced an online ordering system called Marston's Tap. The online platform is available across the majority of Marston's pubs for guests to use, and a full rollout is underway following its success last year. Bookings are being accepted and guests can reserve a table via each pub's website, but pubs will also be accepting walk-ins. Access to toilets and baby changing facilities will be available. While pubs have been closed, where possible, Marston's has invested in and adapted its outdoor spaces and pub gardens to enhance guest experience for the reopening. Ralph Findlay, Chief Executive of Marston, said, "We are delighted we can reopen many of our pubs, but we can't wait until all our pubs can serve customers once again. The resilience of our pub managers and pub partners during this time has been admirable, and we look forward to safely welcoming back guests and reuniting friends and family." Among pubs opening up outdoors on April the 12th will be the Claregate, Roebuck and the Wheatsheaf in Wolverhampton, the 10th Lock, Briley Hill, Spills Meadow, Upper Gornal, Manor House of Whittington, Kinver, Spread Eagle, Gailey, the Greyhound, Stourbridge, British Oak, Kings Wimford, the Forge, Pensnet, and the Wagon and Horses, Wombourne.
A law which could see tougher sentences introduced for animal cruelty offences has been welcomed by a Wolverhampton MP. The Animal Welfare Sentencing Bill has passed through the House of Commons stages and is one step closer to becoming law. The progress has been welcomed by Jane Stevenson, MP for Wolverhampton North East, who owns two Cavalier King Charles Spaniels. Ms. Stevenson said, "I am absolutely delighted that the Animal Welfare Bill has made it through all of its stages in the House of Commons, and I was honoured to serve on the committee which oversaw this. Toughened custodial sentences for animal cruelty offences is the right thing to do, and I know this means a lot to so many pet owners. I thank the government for supporting the legislation and allowing time for it to be debated. As a nation of animal lovers, it cannot be right that we currently have some of the lowest sentences for these offences in the world. So I am pleased that we are one step closer to introducing tougher sentences for animal cruelty. The legislation, known as Finn's Law Part 2, will increase the maximum custodial penalty for animal cruelty offences from 6 months to 5 years. It follows a successful campaign in 2019 to make it an offence to harm animals in the line of their duty, such as police dogs. The bill is named after Finn, a police dog who was attacked along with his owner, PC Dave Wardell, in 2016 while attempting to arrest someone. Finn was awarded the PDSA Gold Medal for Bravery, and both Finn and PC Wardell appeared on Britain's Got Talent. They have since led the campaign to protect service animals and now want to see tougher punishments for animal cruelty. The Animal Welfare Sentencing Bill is set to pass through the House of Lords before receiving royal assent and officially becoming law.
We have two more news updates coming up, but now it's time to cross over to Mina.
Hello and welcome to the Flashback Quiz. All the answers you need can be found later in Flashback Rogers' Did You Know feature. But for now, here are your questions. Are you ready? Question 1. How much is estimated to be spent on chocolate and sweets at Easter? Question 2. How many cream eggs does Cadbury make each year? Question 3. Which part of chocolate bunnies do most folks eat first? Question 4. In what year was the date of Easter set by Act of Parliament? Question 5. What colour were eggs first painted in medieval times? And question 6. What was the Easter bunny first called in Germany? As always, I'll be back to reveal the answers later in the show, but for now, good luck!
Thanks, Mina. Coming up next, we have some more local news, brought to us by Ed, Angela, Ian, and at the top of the bill, it's Christine.
New aerial images have revealed the transformation of disused brownfield land into a £120 million university campus in Wolverhampton. The former Springfield Brewery site in Wolverhampton was once a shadow of its former self, with buildings either fallen down or on the brink of collapse. But it has since been revived and transformed into the University of Wolverhampton's sprawling £120 million Springfield campus. Now, following the completion of a £45 million School of Architecture and Built Environment, the focus is now on building a research centre. Work is now underway to build the £17.5 million National Brownfield Institute on the site after it was backed in December last year. The NBI will be a world-class institute which provides the facility to develop modern methods of building through innovation and partnership with the construction industry. It will focus on the practical application of future brownfield regeneration and remediation through the work of research teams and other professionals. Wolverhampton Council leader, Councillor Ian Brookfield, who spoke at the groundbreaking ceremony at the site, said, "This is a game-changing moment for the city as we break ground on the National Brownfield Institute development. Our planning team worked tirelessly with the university to ensure this important project for our city got on site on time at the European leading built environment education Springfield campus. Once the NBI is built, it will enable Wolverhampton to secure its position as a world leader in sustainable construction, circular economy and brownfield development, and will deliver new skills, jobs and opportunities for local people in the city. It is yet another sign of the confidence being shown in Wolverhampton as a place to invest, as our regeneration plans change our city and help it to recover and relight from the impact of the COVID-19 pandemic."
Dudley's new £18 million leisure centre is set to be named after Duncan Edwards, it has been revealed. Dudley Council chiefs say the facility will be called the Duncan Edwards Leisure Centre in honour of the borough's most famous sporting son. Dudley-born Duncan was part of Manchester United's Busby Babes and a full England international before he tragically lost his life at the age of 21 in 1958 from injuries he sustained in the Munich air disaster. His England caps and football shirts, along with other memorabilia, are on display at Dudley Museum, located on the first floor of the archive building in Tipton Road. Work is progressing well on the new leisure centre in Flood Street, and council bosses hope it will be opened to the public early next year. Councillor Patrick Harley, leader of Dudley Council, said, "We are forging our future in Dudley, with over £1 billion being spent on a number of exciting projects, including the new leisure centre, which will completely regenerate our borough. The new facility will include a 25-metre, 8-lane swimming pool and a teaching pool with spectator provision. There will be a 4-court sports hall available for indoor football, badminton and more. For families with younger children, there will be a soft play area with catering facilities and a party room and a cafe open to all users of the centre. There will also be power-assisted gym equipment for specialist support, which may be particularly beneficial for those recovering from injury, older customers, and those living with long-term health conditions. Millions are also being spent on revamps of Crystal Leisure Centre in Stourbridge and Hales Owen Leisure Centre as part of the biggest spend on leisure services in the borough for decades."
A major new project has been launched to help tackle the digital divide amongst youngsters in Wolverhampton. Wolves Tech Aid aims to collect donated laptops, tablets and other devices and offer them to schools so children can learn online. The project has been launched by Wolverhampton South East MP Pat McFadden and Learn Play Foundation. They are appealing for people and businesses to donate equipment for the cause. During the pandemic, the Department for Education and Wolverhampton Council have provided laptops for youngsters in the city, but some schools say children have been trying to do lessons through parents' mobile phones due to not having access to the right equipment. Mr. McFadden said that with online learning set to be a big part of education in the future, some children could lose out due to gaps in provision. He said there will be a continuing need for online learning, and as education becomes more digital, we have to ensure it doesn't become more unequal. We need to do everything we can to make sure children don't lose out because they don't have the right equipment. Donations of used computers, which can be recycled and put back into use, can make a massive difference to a young child's life. It could be the difference between being able to catch up with what has been lost and that child losing out forever. That's why we are appealing for equipment to be donated, which can be digitally cleaned and made ready for educational use. For further information on donations, you can visit wolvestechaid.com.
One-off payments of £2,000 have been offered to self-employed taxi drivers in Dudley who have been affected by COVID-19. Dudley Council is offering the grant, which can be used to cover business costs for self-employed licensed and private hire drivers. The drivers must live in the borough, regardless of which council they are licensed with, council chiefs have said. Councillor Steve Clark, Cabinet Member for Finance, said, "The borough's taxi drivers have been hit hard by this pandemic, many seeing their trade reduce significantly. We wanted to give taxi drivers this one-off payment to help cover their costs and give them a financial boost to see them through these final months before restrictions are lifted. Grants are still available for other businesses too, so I'd urge anyone who thinks they could be eligible to get in touch immediately." The taxi grants form part of a larger grant funding scheme being offered by the council, which has provided 4,000 businesses with more than £19 million in support from the government. Other grants are still available for businesses which have been forced to close due to national restrictions, including non-essential retail, leisure, personal care, sports facilities and hospitality sectors.
Two entrepreneurs who share a passion for eating local are setting their sights and helping independent eateries bounce back from COVID-19 with the launch of a new online takeaway and click and collect service. Black Country-based Ben Woodall and Matt Brown have been developing Wolverhampton Eats over the last 3 months and are going live with the app and website, giving a timely boost to the city's food and drink scene. Unlike larger national apps, participants will benefit from tailored marketing on social media, no sign-up fees, and a considerable smaller commission on each transaction, making it more competitive at a time when many are looking to emerge from the COVID-19 lockdown. The duo are hoping that Wolverhampton Eats will tap into people's desire to support local businesses, and the cost-effective approach will go some way towards generating additional customers for participating outlets. We know people are fiercely proud and loyal to the city and surrounding areas, but even we have been blown away by the response from the food and drink sector, explained Ben. Plan was to have 30 businesses involved, so we had some critical mass for the launch date, and we smashed that figure in a few months, almost doubling it by the time we are due to go live. He continued, "After all the troubles of the pandemic, independents are looking at new ways of making up for lost revenue, and our app should help deliver that. Wolverhampton Eats is a celebration of the food and drink scene. Enjoy local and buy local is our message, and we believe it will give the sector a much needed lift."
Now we hear from our sight loss advisor, Pete, who asked for some information about dry eye.
Dry eye is a common condition that occurs when your tears aren't able to provide adequate lubrication for your eyes. It may be you don't produce enough tears or produce poor quality tears, and this can lead to inflammation and damage to the eye surface. You may have dry eye if your eyes are itchy, sore, feel uncomfortable, and may sting or burn, If they're gritty, feeling like you have something in your eye. If your eyes are red, if they're blurry and you have eye fatigue. If you're sensitive to lights. If you're having difficulty wearing contact lenses. Difficulty with nighttime driving. Or your eyes are more watery than normal, which is the body's response to the irritation of dry eye. You may be more likely to get dry eye if you're over the age of 50, as tear production tends to diminish as you get older. You wear contact lenses. If you've ever had laser eye surgery. If you look at computer screens for a long time without a break. If you spend time in air-conditioned or heated environments. If it's windy, cold, dry or dusty. If you smoke or drink excessive alcohol. Or if you take certain medicines, for example, some antidepressants or blood pressure drugs. If you have another condition such as blepharitis, Sjogren's syndrome or lupus. If you have a lack of tears. A lack of tears is more common in women, especially due to hormonal changes. And a diet low in vitamin A found in liver, carrots and broccoli, or low in omega-3 fatty acids found in fish, walnuts and vegetable oils could also make you more susceptible to dry eye. If left untreated, severe dry eyes could damage the surface of your eyes and you may have an increased risk of eye infection as your tears protect the surface of your eyes. Dry eye can make it difficult to perform everyday activities such as reading. So the type of things you'd want to avoid would be smoking and drinking too much alcohol. Do not spend too long in smoky, dry or dusty places or too long in air-conditioned or heated rooms. And don't stop taking prescribed medicine for another condition if you feel it may be causing your dry eye. Get medical advice first. To help with dry eye, keep your eyes clean. Take breaks from screens to rest your eyes. Remember the 20-20-20 rule. That's a break every 20 minutes. Look at something 20 feet away and do it for 20 seconds. Make sure your computer screen is at eye level, so not to strain your eyes. Maybe use a humidifier to stop the air getting dry. Remember to rest your eyes and get enough sleep. And if you wear contact lenses, consider wearing glasses to rest your eyes. Also consider wearing wraparound sunglasses to block wind and dry air. A pharmacist may be able to give you further advice on how to keep your eyes clean as well as advice on medication. If you still have dry eyes after trying home treatments for a few weeks, you may want to see an optician or your GP, or recommend treatment, or may refer to an eye specialist for further investigation.
Cheers for that, Pete. Now we have some more local news, brought to us by Ian, Christine, Ed, and starting us off, it's Angela.
A special artwork has left visitors to a Black Country park clinging to it with delight. A local artist who uses cling film to create outdoor pieces has left one of their works at Himley Hall and Park. The artist, who wishes to remain anonymous, has left this latest creation, which depicts a penguin between two trees near the waterfall area of the park. The artist has been attracting attention throughout the region for their quirky work and has been dubbed the Midlands answer to Banksy. Councillor Ian Kettle, Cabinet Member responsible for Hall, said, "We were so pleased to be visited by this local artist and it's great to see their beautiful piece of work on display in the park. We know all too well the difficult times our residents have faced and the sacrifices everyone has made to get COVID-19 under control. But art is something that can bring us together, even at this time when we must be apart. Local people are very much welcome to visit Himley, but as always, we are asking residents to continue to socially distance. Residents must also stay away if they are in a household or bubble where anyone is symptomatic or has had a positive COVID-19 test. Visitors to Himley Hall and Park can buy light refreshments, including tea and coffee, through the hatch on the terrace at the hall. Car parking charges apply at the park, and people are asked to only visit the park if they live locally due to current COVID-19 restrictions. The penguin artwork will be in the park for 2 weeks before being removed in order to be auctioned for charity.
A football club temporarily shut down by the pandemic is bidding for £25,000 worth of building materials to improve its ground for when fans can finally return. Gornal Athletic FC have entered a competition being run by construction firm Buildbase, which will give two grassroots clubs £25,000 each to improve their facilities. Clubs will be judged on how they have supported their communities during the pandemic. The West Midlands Regional League Division 1 outfit face competition from all over the country, but if their bid is successful, the cash would prove crucial to improving their garden walk home. Club Secretary Kevin Williams said, "We would use the money to improve standing facilities, the concrete and the slabs, to make it easier for people to walk around. We would also put some rails up and make it more up to standard. We would need to make improvements if we get promoted." Grassroots football has been devastated by coronavirus, and Gornal are no different. Mr. Williams said the club wouldn't have survived without government grants. He said, "It's been dreadful. We've only played one home match this season. We had a superb crowd. We had 300 people in, which is the most we could have. We could probably have had 500. It was frustrating that we had to finish. We were looking forward to playing all these home matches. Our income has taken a hammering. If it wasn't for the government funding, we would have gone. There is no way we would have survived. The government funding has kept the club running, as we have had no income at all."
The first tiny forest in the Black Country is being planted in Wolverhampton to help residents connect with nature and protect their environment for the future. Wolverhampton Council is working with the OVO Foundation and Earthwatch Europe to create the tiny forest, which will be the size of a tennis court, at Oak Street Open Space in Merrydale. The forest, made up of 600 densely planted native trees, will offer a place for pupils to explore and learn in the local area. Merrydale's tiny forest supports City of Wolverhampton Council's tree and woodland strategy and its open space strategy, as well as forming part of the response to its climate emergency declaration made in July 2019. The forest at Oak Street Open Space will be available for children from local schools to visit and will also be open to the wider community who live in the near site. Councillor John Reynolds, Cabinet Member for Children and Young People and Chair of Governors at Merrydale Primary School, said, "Tiny forests really do prove that small is beautiful. They may appear little, but they bring huge benefits to the local area." Simon Lane, head teacher at Merrydale Primary School, said, "Merrydale Primary has always had a commitment to the opportunities for learning and enjoyment in the outdoors. The school offers woodland walks, pond dipping, forest schools and bird watching. The arrival of the tiny forest will offer an exciting new resource to widen our pupils' experience and offer recognition of the roles trees play in all our lives."
A Black Country zoo has welcomed an adorable new arrival ahead of its planned reopening in the spring. Dudley Zoo announced this week that endangered ring-tailed lemurs Phoebe and Frank had a new baby on February the 20th. Rachel Hickman, press officer at the zoo, said the keepers had not been able to give a name to the baby as Phoebe had been very protective of it. She said, "We won't be able to work out the sex of the baby for a while, as the mother will always keep the baby close to its stomach for the first few weeks. The keepers may have had a chance to look, but nothing's been confirmed yet. But we know it's doing well, as I've seen it looking around. It's incredible, though, and really nice to see new babies. And the zoo is delighted to welcome a new baby, which brings another new arrival to Lima Wood. The new arrival will live with its parents and alongside siblings Spock, Nelly, Kelly, Icarus, Kinich, Itsy, Bitsy, Tom, Jerry, Kirk, Sarek, Sulu, Spider, Loki and Ronnie. Rachel Hickman said that while 19-year-old Phoebe and 18-year-old Frank conceived 20 babies, some of the older lemurs were sent off to other breeding programs. She said, "Phoebe has been doing all the work to look after it and she's very experienced after so many babies, so we haven't needed to do anything. There have been other new arrivals here as well, with a baby skink being born and a lot of other animals being expectant, so spring is definitely in the air at the zoo. We hope people will be able to enjoy it when the zoo can reopen next month, with visitors required to wear masks due to being in close proximity to the animals."
Now it's time to hear from Flashback Roger, who has for us some more amazing facts.
Hello everybody, Roger here again with this week's batch of unusual facts and events from far and wide. I hope you'll find them interesting and entertaining. The quiz questions, of course, will follow later. And as ever, the answers can be found in this section. So if you're sitting comfortably, I shall begin. Easter is a strong contender to Halloween for leader in the chocolate and sweet consuming championship. It's estimated that more than £3 billion is spent on confection treats during the religious celebration, so it makes sense that the Easter Bunny is responsible for giving Halloween a run for its money. Now, over 90 million chocolate bunnies are sold for Easter, and surprisingly, 59% of people eat the ears first. Only a handful start with a feet or tail, and the rest apparently either don't have a plan of action or refuse to state their preference. Now that brings me nicely onto a firm favourite, which is a famous Cadbury's cream egg. More than 1.5 million Cadbury cream eggs are made every day, would you believe? Even more impressive is that Bourneville factory in Birmingham makes 500 million of the things every year. If you pile those eggs on top of each other, they'd be taller than Everest. So, how do you eat yours? However you do it, your personal method is yours and to be savoured. Personally, mine go in two halves. Easter is a movable feast and is declared by Parliament in the Easter Act of 1928. Easter Day is now the first Sunday following the first full moon following the 21st of March. This year's full moon, after the 21st of March, will be on the 28th. So the following Sunday is Easter Sunday. The egg is an important symbol of birth, and the word Easter lies in the Greek word for egg, which is estrus. The tradition of painting eggs dates back to medieval times, when eggs were first painted red to represent the blood of Christ. The next one that comes hopping along is the Easter Bunny, also called the Easter Rabbit or Easter Hare. It's a folkloric figure and symbol of Easter, depicted as a rabbit bringing Easter eggs. Originating in the 17th century among German Lutherans, the Easter Hare originally played the role of judge, evaluating whether children were good or disobedient in behaviour at the start of the season of Easter time. Well, that's it for this week's offering, folks. So I'm off to put the finishing touches to my Easter bonnet. I'll be back after Easter with some more snippets for you. But for now, this is Rod saying bye for now. Ta-ra!
Thanks, Roger. Now we head over to Mina with the weather forecast for the week ahead.
The weather for this week ahead will start off wet, but will become drier and warmer as the week progresses. Temperatures across the week will be slightly higher than usual for the time of year. Due to the time of year, low UV levels are expected all week. The sunrise and sunset times are 6:51 a.m. for the sunrise and 7:37 p.m. for the sunset. For Friday, 26th of March, we have hail showers and a moderate breeze with a maximum temperature of 8 degrees. On Saturday, 27th of March, we have sunny intervals and a moderate breeze with a maximum temperature of 10 degrees. On Sunday, 28th of March, we have light cloud and a moderate breeze with a maximum temperature of 13 degrees. Moving on to Monday 29th and Tuesday 30th of March, we have sunny intervals and a moderate breeze with a maximum temperature of 15 degrees. And finally on Wednesday 31st of March and Thursday 1st of April, we have light cloud and a gentle breeze with a maximum temperature of 13 degrees. So that's your forecast for this week. However, before I go, I'd like to remind you that this weekend the clocks change going forward 1 hour on Sunday 28th of March as the UK enters British summertime, giving us all an extra hour of daylight in the evening. So, with that said, as always, enjoy the weather!
Thanks that, Mina. Now we head to some more Sounds of Nature, which this week is brought to us by Ed.
Corn bunting is a sparrow-sized streaky brown bird of hedgerows and farmland that feeds on seeds and invertebrates. In the winter, it will join mixed flocks of buntings, finches and sparrows to feed on seeds on farmland. Male corn buntings are often seen perched on top of bushes, singing loudly, a song that sounds like a jangling set of keys. Male corn buntings might mate with up to 18 different females in a season. The female builds her grass nest in rough grassy margins or arable crops and incubates the eggs by herself. The male may help her to feed the chicks once they have hatched.
This recording was made by Lawrence Shove and was made available by the British Library. Coming up next, we have Ian with the sport.
Hello, I'm Ian, and here's your latest football news. Wolves goal hero Steve Bull feels for current strikers Willian José and Fabio Silva and hopes one of them gets a lucky goal soon. Experienced target man José has gone 9 games without a goal since his arrival from Spanish side Real Sociedad. Club record capture Silva, meanwhile, has not netted since the Black Country derby to Albion on January the 16th. On the struggles of the pair, 306-goal legend Bull said, "I feel for them in a way, being a former striker. You feed off crosses coming in and balls into feet which you can work with, but they've been very, very sparse. I played with a strike partner for most of my career, and we would have chance after chance, week in and week out. That isn't the case at the moment, so they've got to be patient. But when they do get the chance, it's going to be one of the last chances they have in a game, so they need to be on the ball and have the eye of the tiger." Portuguese goalkeeper Rui Patricio will not join the rest of the Portuguese squad for their upcoming World Cup qualifiers with Azerbaijan, Serbia and Luxembourg. Patricio suffered a worrying head injury during the 1-0 defeat to Liverpool on Monday night, but he has responded positively since. However, the 33-year-old was deemed unfit to travel by Wolves medical department. A statement from the Portuguese national team read, "Rui Patricio was declared unfit by the FPF Health and Performance Unit. The player has not recovered satisfactorily from the trauma suffered at the service of Wolverhampton FC and will continue his recovery process in England. Patricio will continue to be closely monitored at Compton Park." Olympiacos keeper José Sá replaces his compatriot in the squad. Wolves have a long break in schedule until their home clash with West Ham United on April the 5th. Club legend Chris Brunt admits to finding himself on a steep learning curve after joining Albion's coaching staff. Brunt returned to the Hawthorns earlier this month, agreeing to become assistant to under-23's boss Dion Burton, initially until the end of the season. The 36-year-old first held talks with Baggies sporting director Luke Dowling after problems with a calf injury saw him released by Bristol City in January. Brunt said, "At the time, all I wanted to do was rehab, but as the time went on, more and more coaching was something I thought I should have a go at. I am delighted Albion have given me the opportunity, at the moment, till the end of the season. It has been good so far. It has been different. There are little bits and pieces that you don't see as a player." Brunt, who scored 49 goals in 421 appearances during his 13-year stay at the Hawthorns before leaving last summer, is keeping his long-term options open for now. The Northern Ireland international has long considered a move into coaching following retirement, including spending time working on his UEFA A licence a decade ago. He believes hands-on practice will now allow him to make an informed decision on his future. Brunt continued, "I'm learning as I go. We have meetings in the morning with the academy staff, sports science and physios. It's different watching from the sidelines. You try and watch specific things rather than the whole game. It is definitely a learning curve, but one that as a player you don't really think about. As you get older, you do think about it more, and it had probably been in my thoughts for the last 6 months or so. I am going to give it my all to the end of the season." Dara O'Shea says he will leave no stone unturned in his quest to be a success for Albion. In a difficult campaign for the Baggies, O'Shea has been one of their shining lights, thanks to his versatility and consistent performances across the back line. Current boss Sam Allardyce recently praised the Irishman's application, while former chief Slaven Bilic spoke highly of his attitude. And 22-year-old O'Shea prides himself on being mentally switched on, as he said, "Football is probably more mental than it is anything else. Having the right attitude sets the platform for you and gives you a real chance to go on and improve. I'd like to regard myself as having a good attitude and trying to do things right. I've been given this amazing opportunity as an Irish kid to come over here, so when I came over, I didn't want to waste it or leave any stones unturned." O'Shea, having come over to England in 2017, made his senior breakthrough as Albion went on to win the championship last season, and has continued to impress in the top flight. He was a victim of his own versatility when Allardyce first arrived at the Hawthorns, being switched between centre-back, right-back and left-back. Albion's next fixture is on Saturday the 3rd of April away at Chelsea.
Up now it's Liz, who takes a look back at how COVID-19 affected 2020.
It has been a year like no other, and while the coronavirus has changed all our lives in a way few would have imagined, people in the West Midlands can see some light at the end of the tunnel as the threat begins to recede. But on a cold, wet morning in Bridgnorth, the scars of the past 12 months are clear for all to see. Shuttered shops, closed pubs, the normally bustling high street, a shadow of its former self. Will things ever be the same again? How many of the small businesses forced to close due to the lockdown will reopen when the pandemic is over? How soon will normal life resume? Stay-at-home mother Sarah Evans, 42, who lives in the town's Lisley Street, is hopeful that better times are around the corner. Although she thinks some aspects of the government's timetable may be optimistic. "I don't think anyone ever imagined we would be going through this commotion, not for this length of time," she says. She has mixed feelings about the government's handling of the pandemic. "I think it would have been very hard for anyone who was in power," she says. "There's a lot of good decisions that have been made, but sometimes the decisions could have been made sooner, particularly when he was being advised by the scientists. But I think the Prime Minister did what he could because it was new, and it was new for all of us, and it was a difficult decision knowing how and when to act in different situations. I think we are much better educated about it now." Miss Evans says the government has done a good job with its vaccination programme and is hopeful some degree of normality will return soon. "I think the government is hoping things will start opening up again at the end of April, but I think it will be a bit longer than that, more like summer," she says. "I still think we're going to be outside for a lot of things for a long time. I just hope they will allow bigger groups to meet, even if it means wearing PPE. I think the important thing is getting people vaccinated and getting regular top-ups." Miss Evans says that while she tries to support local shops, it could be hard for many of the smaller businesses to reopen once restrictions are eased. Taking a slightly fatalistic view is Elsa McWilliam, 85, who also lives in the town. "It's got to get better, hasn't it? It can't get any worse," she says. But despite her apparent cynicism, Mrs. McWilliam says the pandemic has not had much of an impact on her life. "I feel all right. I'm 85 and I'm doing quite well, or so people tell me," she says. "It hasn't had much effect on me, having to keep myself in. I don't go out very often anyway, so it doesn't bother me at all." Like many people in the town, 67-year-old Colin Beasley from Highley is full of praise for the way the government has handled the vaccine programme, but feels it should have acted sooner at the start of the pandemic. He says, "I think it's gone rather well with the appointments. People are getting the jabs, but it will never be back to normal. I think we'll be living like this for a long time. It will be like the Spanish flu in 1919. It will be with us for a while. They should have shut down from day one, like they did in New Zealand. We're an island race. We should have let nobody in." Mr. Beasley, who is retired, says for him the biggest effect of the lockdown has been that he cannot return to his hometown of Liverpool. But he says he appreciates that he has suffered far less than many people. I'm lucky. I live right out in the sticks and we don't see anybody anyway, he says. But it must be terrible for single parents with four kids living in a flat. Roger Cusworth, 70, thinks the worst is now over. I think we're nearing the end. I think the government has done very well in organising the vaccine and it is giving people a lot more confidence, he says. I think it's been hard for many people not being able to visit family members and it has put pressure on a lot of businesses. Mr. Cusworth, who is a property landlord, says many of his tenants have suffered greatly as a result of the lockdown and has been forced to give a lot of them a rent holiday. It's had a big effect on my income, he says. Despite this, he is generally pleased with the way the government has handled the crisis, saying he thinks it has probably got the balance about right. I think they're doing a good job overall, he says, although he was less impressed by the 37 billion test and trace system, which was heavily criticised by the all-party parliamentary watchdog, the Public Accounts Committee, last week. Test and trace was a waste of time. It wasn't needed in the first place. Kevin Williams, who recently retired from running the fruit and vegetable stall at the indoor market, says it came as a big shock when it emerged how serious the threat was 12 months ago. The first lockdown gave us a fright. Nobody knew quite what was happening, said Mr. Williams. I don't think things are ever going to be the same again. I think people are going to be wearing face masks for a long time. It isn't helping the economy. It's frightening people. David Allen, 73, from Bridgnorth, said he was not in the slightest bit worried, saying that the vaccine had given him confidence. But he said he was annoyed by people who continued to flout the guidelines. They may have the right not to wish to take the vaccination. They also want the right to mix with other people, he says. But we know that one in three people are asymptomatic, and you have people who are refusing to take the vaccine, people who are refusing to follow the guidelines, and people who are unknowingly asymptomatic. You know it's going to be spreading. Mr. Allen, who works for a charity which provides support for the elderly, said the government should have been stricter with its enforcement of the restrictions, although he adds that he has some sympathy with the predicament it found itself in. At the start, I thought it was Boris being his usual bumbling, shambolic self, he says. But when I stopped to think that 1918 was the last time we have experienced anything like this, then I knew it would always be a case of learning as we go along. So I'm more measured and more patient now. The way that they have handled the vaccine has been world-leading. The problem has been that there have been two different parties within the Tory party, with the one wanting to keep the economy running and continuing to trade right across the pandemic. Mr. Allen says his daughter lives in Australia, where the approach has been much tougher. There, they have drones flying over people's gardens to ensure that they are complying with the guidelines. The police are much stricter when it comes to stopping people in their cars and asking where they are going, and the fines are quite horrendous, he says. I don't know whether the Australian approach would be accepted here, whether people would accept the infringement on their civil liberties.
Thanks for that, Liz. It's now time to find out how many questions you got right in our flashback quiz. So, Mina, do you have the answers all lined up for us?
I do. So here are your answers for this week's flashback quiz. Are you ready? Question 1. How much is estimated to be spent on chocolate and sweets at Easter? The answer? Over 3 billion. Question 2. How many cream eggs does Cadbury make each year? And the answer? 500 million. Question 3. Which part of chocolate bunnies do most folks eat first? And the answer? The ears. Well, I have to admit I do as well. Question 4. In what year was the date of Easter set by Act of Parliament? And the answer here is 1928. Question 5. What colour were eggs first painted in the medieval times? And the answer is red. And finally, question 6. What was the Easter Bunny first called in Germany? And the answer here is the Easter Hare. How did you do? Great, I hope. But if not, there's always another chance to have another go when we return on the 14th of April. Now, to end this week's edition of the Black Country Talking News, it's time to visit Graham Fisher to hear one of his tales from the barn.
Hello. Although we all have our own ways of stringing random thoughts into articulate sentences, I'm sure most of my fellow scribes would agree that it is often helpful to languidly contemplate as the grey matter juggles the words into place, ready to be transmitted to the fingertips and thence to the paper or computer screen. Inspiration is key in avoiding the dreaded blank page syndrome, and looking out of my window across the River Wye, I'm minded that if one cannot find inspiration here, then it really is time to call it a day. Directly in my line of sight, in what seems just a stone's throw but is in reality about a mile as the crow flies, lie the ruins of Clifford Castle. Situated on a promontory overlooking a river crossing, the term Cliff Ford becomes coherent. Now in private hands, it opens to the public on several days per year. This early Mott and Bailey edifice was built in 1070 by William FitzOsborne, 1st Earl of Hereford, and was intended to provide protection for a planned Norman settlement. One of its most notable incumbents in later years was Rosamond Clifford, known for her beauty as Fair Rosamond and famous as the mistress of Henry II. A property nearby is still known as Rosamond House. Not quite in line of sight from the barn, but only a matter of a couple of miles from Clifford Castle, and just inside the parish border, is Hay Castle. Seriously damaged by fires, it has since 2011 been owned by the Hay Castle Trust, who plan to renovate it as an arts and education centre. This is a medieval fortification and 17th century mansion house, but was also constructed in consequence of the Norman invasion of Wales. Castles are well represented in this part of the world, and one particular website lists over 400 known examples around the Principality and the Marches. Many were built either to help contain local volatility or repair threats emanating from further afield. Some were destined to be associated with events of great moment. One particular name frequently associated in such struggles is that of Owain Glyndwr, of circa 1349 to 1416. Described by Shakespeare in Henry IV Part 1 as not in the role of common men, he was a virulent proponent of Welsh nationalism who opposed the occupying English in the early 15th century. His family was taken prisoner in 1408 when the castles at Aberystwyth and Harlech fell to the king's forces. Castles were often modified or otherwise used over the centuries for other purposes, notably during the Civil War. However, as with Clifford and Hay, the latter suffering damage at the hands of Glyndwr's forces in 1400, and also featuring in the Wars of the Roses, a goodly proportion of them have some connection with the events of 1066. The Black Country's own Dudley Castle originally started life as a wooden Mott and Bailey that was built soon after the Norman conquest. In the 12th century, it was rebuilt in stone, but demolished on the orders of King Henry II, and rebuilt again sometime from the second half of the 13th century, before John Dudley, 1st Duke of Northumberland, constructed the range of buildings within the fortifications that we see today. I have mused elsewhere on the Battle of Hastings, and on two of its greatest postscripts, namely the Bayeux Tapestry and the Domesday Book, both of which were a direct legacy of the battle. So, no surprise that my attention was drawn to the recent news of proposals to transfer the tapestry on loan from its present home in the city of the same name in northern France. The Bayeux Tapestry is thought to date from a few years after the battle that it depicts. Almost 230 feet long and just shy of 2 feet tall, it comprises some 50 scenes leading up to and culminating in the Battle of Hastings, and is more accurately fashioned in an embroidery technique. This has exercised some scholars in recent years to adopt the term Bayeux embroidery, perhaps more technically accurate, but somehow lacking the romanticism. Whatever your choice of nomenclature, it is a masterpiece. And in her 2005 book, La Tapisserie de Bayeux, medievalist expert Sylvette Lemanian describes it as one of the supreme achievements of the Norman Romanesque. Its survival of 9 centuries is little short of miraculous. Its exceptional length, the harmony and freshness of its colour, its exquisite workmanship and the genius of its guiding spirit combine to make it endlessly fascinating. A figure on the tapestry that appears to depict a soldier with an arrow in his eye reinforces the popular fable of King Harold's demise. It is in reality more likely he was hacked to death, but the arrow in the eye legend persists. The prospect of the tapestry being brought to England, a mammoth task if only in view of its sheer bulk and venerability, represents a unique opportunity to appreciate this awesome record of a most turbulent period in our history. Yet it is not necessary to wait to get a flavour of the tapestry, for we already have one of our own. And, what is more, it enjoys connections with Staffordshire and the Black Country. The British Bayeux Tapestry was the brainchild of Lady Elizabeth Wardle, a skilled embroiderer. Elizabeth was born in Staffordshire and educated in Stone, Alton and Codsall. Stone was home to some excellent needleworkers, and she may have learnt her embroidery skills there. She married Thomas Wardle, a silk industrialist, in 1857 at St Edward's Parish Church in Leek, and bore him 14 children, although only 9 survived childhood. By the time she and Thomas founded the Leek School of Embroidery and the Embroidery Society around the turn of the 1880s, she had already earned a reputation as a fine needlewoman. Multi-talented and philanthropic, she supported various charities and in 1891 even wrote a cookery book. She was especially skilled in the embroidery of figures, and following a visit to France to see the Bayeux Tapestry in 1885, it was her idea to make an accurate replica, as she put it, so that England should have a copy of its own. 35 needleworkers from Staffordshire and elsewhere outside the region worked under Elizabeth for over a year, and the completed tapestry was exhibited in Leek before then being taken on tour around Britain and Europe. In 1895, it was on show in Reading when a former mayor purchased it and presented it as a gift to the people for display in Reading Museum and Art Gallery. In 1993, a purpose-built gallery at the museum was opened where the entire tapestry can now be seen. It is indeed accurate. That is, to a point. Perhaps in deference to Victorian reserve, certain sensitive areas of the male form are visible in the original, are discreetly obscured in the replica. As for the Black Country connection, it was Thomas Wardle's collaboration with one of the giants of the 19th century arts and craft movement that encouraged Elizabeth to undertake the Bayeux Tapestry project. His name was William Morris. William Morris, 1834 to 1896, was variously a textile designer, poet, novelist, translator, and social activist. He was a major contributor to the revival of traditional methods of production and played a significant role in propagating socialism in Britain. Elizabeth Wardle's brother George, who died in 1910, was the manager of William Morris's company for 20 years. Morris's mastery of wallpapers and fabrics can still be seen at the Wolverhampton home of the Mander family, prominent in the area's business and public life for over 2 centuries. Given to the care of the National Trust in 1937, and now a tourism magnet for both enthusiasts of the arts and craft movement and aficionados of high design, the house is more usually known as Whittick Manor. Enjoy your Black Country, and do join me again soon for more tales from the barn.
So that's it for another edition of the Black Country Talking News. A reminder to our CD listeners who have received CDs in padded envelopes that you don't need to send anything back to us. If you have a sight loss tip or someone you would like to wish a happy birthday to, just say hello to. Maybe even a poem or talking book you would like reviewed, then please get in touch with us at the Beacon Centre. Call 01902 880111. Email bctn@beaconvision.org or write to us at the Black Country Talking News, Beacon, Wolverhampton Road East, Wolverhampton, WV4 6AZ. We look forward to hearing from you. Thank you for listening, and thank you to all our supporters, donators and volunteers who without their support we would be unable to run this free service. Please note the information and views expressed in this recording does not necessarily represent the views of Beacon or Talking News and were accurate at the time of recording. Mentions of goods and services does not imply endorsement, and whilst every care is taken to supply accurate information, Beacon and Talking News do not undertake liability for any errors. So it's goodbye from all of us. Stay safe. Ta-ra!